Hey, we're going to reconvene and our informational hearings. And the next portion of our agenda is going to review the legislative concepts that we're introducing as a committee. And actually, one of them, I just want to make sure for the record that you know, LC-26 is not a committee recommendation. The first three that we're going to hear are. So with that, just to clarify for the record, this is an informational hearing only. We have invited testimony, and the reason is that we don't officially convene as a legislature until February, and then in February we will have a full public hearings on all of these concepts, which will be, I think they'll have bill numbers by then, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. So with that, we're going to start with LC-236, which is relating to lighting that contains mercury. Beth, do you want to provide us with a summary? And do we have copies in the back of all the LCs?
I believe we do.
Yes. And they're also available online. So if folks are listening, they're on the Legislative Committee website if you'd like to follow along online. And all the members should have them. And so I just want to make it clear that we're just having a few invited testimony speakers today, but we'll have the full public hearings in February.
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, this is LC-236. This bill was heard during the 2011 session, or a similar bill was. The bill at this point, as an LC, does three main things. It sets mercury content standards for certain types of light bulbs. It establishes a state procurement policy on for lighting. Also directs some additional education responsibilities on how to recycle lighting that contains mercury. And then, I'm sorry, there were actually four things. Fourth, it requires the Department of Environmental Quality to make a report back to the legislature on collection and recycling opportunities for this type of lighting.
Okay, so we have Palmer Mason from the Department of Environmental Quality, and then Mark Cohorse, the National Electrical Manufacturers Association. Mark? And Mark came from the East Coast. I'm sure you're happy to come here for the snow. So, anyway, welcome, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Palmer, if you can provide a background, I think committee members will remember that we've been working on this for quite a while. There was a legislation last session. Senator Olson and I, we put together a work group during the interim, which Beth staffed, and so we've come up with some draft legislation that we're hoping will be consensus legislation. We've had all the parties working together, and I think we've had some input from NEMA on this. But Palmer, if you can provide a little bit of an overview, and then Mark, like to hear the perspective from the industry.
Okay. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. As the chair indicated, we've been working on this issue for several years. And there was a bill last session in the 2011 session. This bill that is being looked at now is a little different. It does not include a component where manufacturers would have to set up take-back programs for the collection and recycling of mercury lighting. This bill, as Beth indicated, is focused more on setting content standards, the level of mercury in bulbs and lamps. That is an issue that we are working with the industry on, and I need to acknowledge a couple things. The industry has made a lot of progress in the product that they sell. They've reduced mercury considerably over the last 10 to 15 years. But there is still an amount of mercury in lamps and bulbs, and mercury is one of those substances that is highly toxic and is a concern for our agency and other agencies here in Oregon, as well as for EPA. And so there's interest in trying to reduce mercury to the point where we have as little as possible while still providing good lighting products. And again, credit to the industry for doing a lot of work in their engineering and design of bulbs and lamps to reduce that. But we still have an issue where many bulbs with mercury, particularly compact fluorescent light bulbs, are sold in this country. That is absolutely a good thing. We want to be switching from incandescent bulbs to CFLs. The energy savings are just, it's incomparable how much energy you save with a CFL. The issue is once the bulb is spent, what do you do with it, and how do you manage it? That was really, again, the subject of the bill last session. What is in this particular bill is a report on that issue. But in the interim, I think what we're what is being thought out with this legislation is how do we reduce, again, the content, the mercury content of light bulbs. And that's something the department is very interested in. And as the chair alluded to, the discussions have been going on with the industry, and I think they're getting closer to that. And the goal from the department's perspective is, again, to try to get light bulbs that have as little mercury as possible, but that also can be sold in a cost-effective way, and it's technically feasible for the industry to get to that standard. And so I'm hopeful that we're close to that point if we're not exactly there. The other components of the bill, I think, are helpful to the larger issue of managing this type of waste products. The provisions about educating people on their options for recycling, this would be a requirement for local governments to include in their waste management programs. And also the requirement, or the direction rather, to the Department of Administrative Services to consult with DEQ when the state makes purchasing decisions about lighting and trying to buy lighting that has the least amount of mercury. I think the state has an opportunity to help drive the marketplace and drive lighting that has less mercury, and this is an opportunity for Oregon to again, in the small way that we can, help drive that marketplace. So I think there's a number of good provisions in the bill addressing those issues. And then I guess the last issue that I will talk about is the report that the department is to send the legislature in October of this year if this bill were to pass. And that's a report, again, on this collection issue of folks are buying many more compact fluorescent light bulbs. It's a good thing. We want to encourage that. But then we have an issue of what do we do with the product after it's been spent and after it's been used. And so the report is designed to bring the stakeholders together, and DEQ would have a public process, get the information, and come back to the legislature on a recommendation about the most cost-effective way to establish a convenient collection and recycling system for mercury lighting in the state. And that would be a set of recommendations the legislature could act upon if it chose to. And that's really the essence of the bill. Be happy to take any questions.
Why don't we, let's hear from Mr. Hohorst first, and then we'll open it up for questions. Thank you for making the trip out here.
You're welcome, Madam Chair. I'm pleased to be here. No snow yet, but I have the pleasure of having to drive up to Olympia from here, so no telling what I'm going to run into on that trip. Anyway, I'm pleased to be here. For the record, I'm Mark Kohorst. I'm Senior Manager for Environment, Health, and Safety at NEMA, and we're the National Electrical Manufacturers Association. We represent the largest and most well-known lamp manufacturing companies in the U.S. As Palmer mentioned, manufacturers have continually demonstrated their commitment to addressing this issue, and the issue being mercury in energy-efficient lighting. The mercury content in compact fluorescent lamps and linear fluorescent lamps, the ones above us here and that we, you know, are in all commercial industrial settings, has declined dramatically, 80 to 90% over the last couple decades. The manufacturers have set a voluntary ceiling for themselves for compact fluorescent lamps. Not only for members of NEMA, but non-NEMA members, other manufacturers, have signed on to that commitment as well. This has been in place, and it has since ratcheted its maximum level downward in response to engineering advances and the state of the market. That being the case, we generally support states in their efforts to set the limits on mercury content in lamps, and we generally support what is being attempted here through this LC. What we guard against, and the reason we're primarily engaged, is trying to simply replicate the standards that were developed in the European Union in the U.S. There has been a tendency for states to do this. They look to what's known as the ROHS directive. If you're not familiar with this, this is a rather groundbreaking continent-wide directive in the U.S. I'm sorry, in the EU, that has addressed the content of several types of hazardous materials in all sorts of consumer electronics products, lamps included. And a number of states in the U.S. have looked to this directive as a model for what they should then set in their own states, which is understandable. The problem is And this is where it gets complicated, and this is where we need to engage to set the record straight. The European directive is a European law made for the European electrical infrastructure and products sold therein. And there are qualitative differences. There are very important differences. The electrical system, if you've traveled there, most of you probably have, you know, you take an adapter with you, the electrical system is different. Consequently, the lamps and other types of products that sell there are different from those in the U.S. So it doesn't work to directly transpose the law that they passed into state law in the U.S. We have discussed this with a number of states. California at great length for AB 1109, and that was the first state law to attempt to do this. And our members worked directly with your counterparts in California to come up with a law that was more appropriate to the U.S. market. We've also spoken and conferred with Maine, with Vermont, and currently with the state of New York on exactly the same issue. So, that being the case, that was our mindset in coming here for these discussions with the department, with staff, Ms. Petrino, and so forth, on what to do in Oregon. And looking now at LC 236, what we see is we're now much closer. I mean, I think it's we commend the work that's been done to modify this so that the language is more appropriate and oriented towards the U.S. market. We support the intent of Section 3 in LC, which is where the standards are, and we basically agree with the text, but we still have some changes that we would like to propose that would make it directly suitable for the U.S. market. I don't have them with me. We will have them within a few days. My members are conferring as we speak on the final draft, and we will have them well in time for the February 2nd hearing or whatever is scheduled. So we're very close. We appreciate the effort so far. We have, as I said, slight changes that reflect the types of lamps sold in the U.S., the standards that apply to products in the U.S. and so forth, as well as some definitional changes. So we're happy to work with you on that. We'll have our proposed version very shortly.
All right, thank you. I'll see if there's any questions. I know, Senator Olson, did you have a question?
I do.
Yeah.
You had mentioned the ROHS, and you, as you noticed in our bill in 236, it is in there. Do you have any concerns about that? If California accepts this, that we will also accept it, or?
Well, what California did, California based its standard on the original ROHS directive, which was enacted in 2003. And their law says that their standards reflect the ROHS directive as amended thereafter. However, if you compare the two, you will see the California law does have several sections in there that differ, that extend beyond the ROHS directive for exactly the reasons I just mentioned. Now, what complicates the matter is that that directive has been recast. It's been rewritten and reenacted. So the original California language that says we are passing this in accordance with the ROHS directive doesn't apply to that recast. You know, it applies to the original directive and any amendments to the recast, which is an entirely new directive reissued this past July. So California has a legal question as to what they need to do to conform directly to that new directive. I'm certainly not here to speak for them, but I do know that, you know, their current law does not allow them to directly refer to a new document, a new law in the US, in the EU. It's likely that they are going to have legislative action to do that. I'm not an expert. Please don't quote me on that. But I know that, you know, we have talked to them at length about this. So,
Palmer, do you have a comment on that?
Yes, Senator Dingfelder. I think Mark has pretty much accurately portrayed the situation. California's law is a little ambiguous about what happened under this recast. This, I think it was almost more like a roll-up of the ROHS, but they did add some new standards, and the question is, what are these new standards? Now, California will have, supposedly starting this year, or has started, go to the 3.5 milligrams for CFLs that are under 30 watts, which is what is in the LC. So the intent, I think, for this LC is to track what California is doing now. I think the point of this provision, Senator Olson, the one you're referring to, is to say if California does work it out and figure out what their next step is, and I think Mark's right, it may very well require legislative change, then DEQ would report back to the Oregon Legislative Assembly to basically say this is what California's done, and the legislature can make a decision at that point about whether Oregon also moves to those standards.
I have one follow-up. Mm-hmm. Very, very quick. Palmer, on NELC, we talk about the milligrams of mercury, but we exclude straight fluorescent T8 lighting.
Yeah, it's on
that would be page 3, line 15. And I just was wondering why.
You know, Senator, I'm not sure I can answer that question. I'm going to have to get you an answer about why that particular language was you know, written that way.
Okay, that's fine.
Yeah, all right.
I was going to say, Mark, you probably can. This is under, it's lines 14 through 19, because it's also for high output models of nonlinear fluorescence. So I wanted to make sure where that language came from, if that was mirrored in California. You see where we are?
I do, and that actually is something that we may change, so I hesitate to sort of state a position on that. Madam Chair, I would like to offer one more comment on the LC, if I could. This, all our discussion has been on Section 3. The other aspect of the proposal here that we would address is the report that Palmer mentioned, and this would be in Section 8. And NEMA has, I guess, a number of concerns with that provision. I guess I would summarize them as follows. The first is that it does not limit its scope to lamps sold for household use. And that's a very important distinction for the industry. And the reason being, if you're talking about lamp recycling, it's very important to distinguish between the household sector and the commercial and industrial sector. Which is the latter being the area where by far the majority of lamps are used and disposed. That would be buildings like this, schools, institutions, I mean any large commercial or industrial structure or institutional structure. There is a national network of recycling facilities that is in place that provides recycling services to that sector. And it's all done under private contract. They have their own association. We work with them closely. They will tell you that they will recycle any business's lamps anywhere in the world, and they have a program of services for any customer. That sector, we believe, legislatures do not need to address. It is in place. It's a question of enforcement. In most cases, those buildings, those operators, building owners, building managers, need to recycle those lamps by law and may not be doing so. They need to do so. The industry is there to serve them. It's more a question of enforcement than anything. Our concern, and where we mostly deal with legislatures, is the residential market, folks like us.
And just to let you know, the intent was or is to limit it to household. I think it's just a drafting error.
The other thing we'd say about that is basically we already know what the department's position is. I mean, they have been very clear on this. The report that they issued after the year-long stakeholder process pretty much set the framework for what their recommendation would be. And we kind of see this as an exercise that doesn't need to take place. One other detail we would also mention is that it asks for recommendations on labeling, and we're very concerned about that.
Just in response to that, the legislature has not had those recommendations presented to them. So even though you know, there's been some processes that's gone forward, those have not been officially presented to the legislature. So what this does is basically say, the department's going to present the recommendations. It's still up to the legislature to take any action on that. So I know there's been discussions with the industry, but those have not been presented to the legislature. So this provides a mechanism for doing that.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry. Didn't the report go to the legislature, the report from the stakeholder process?
Yeah, but it was not presented specifically for this issue,
It
wasn't presented in a – you know, it was submitted, but it wasn't presented through an official format like this with recommendations.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, great. We'll probably see you back here, I'm sure, in a few weeks. And if you can get your recommendations to the committee staff and copy DEQ on that.
Very soon.
Great.
Thank you for your attention.
Okay, so do we need to close the informational hearing, or?
You can just.
Okay. So we'll go on to our next informational hearing for LC 157 relating to ecosystem services. Beth, if you can provide us with an overview.
Madam Chair, members, LC 157 would expand the state's policy on ecosystem services, directs the governor's office working with OWEB to facilitate a review of relevant conservation plans that could affect such services, and propose a process for such plans to be aligned and coordinated. It also directs the Institute for Natural Resources to provide information on public domain integrated ecosystem services methodologies. It does a number of other things related to ecosystem services, which I'm sure will be addressed by the presenters.
Okay. Great. We have Sarah Vickerman from Defenders of Wildlife. Well, you guys are all here already. Bobby Cochran from Willamette Partnership and John Chandler with the Home Builders. So who'd like to go first?
Hi. Thank you very much, Chair Dingfelder. My name is Sarah Vickerman. I'm with Defenders of Wildlife. And I'm just going to give you a little background on the bill and a brief overview about what we think it will accomplish, and then the other two members of the panel will discuss some of the other elements of its implementation. The origin of this bill is that it implements the recommendations of a work group that met for about a year called the Senate Bill 513 work group. The legislature passed Senate Bill 513 relating to ecosystem services and markets in 2009, and part of the bill directed that this work group meet and ponder some more complex and thorny questions about how to implement ecosystem services. And so the group came up with a report. And this is a copy of it. I'll be happy to make these available to you either in hard copy or electronically. And this group had about 40 people on it, and it represented quite a diversity of interests from state and local, federal agencies, nonprofit organizations, businesses, and landowner groups. So you all probably know what ecosystem services are, but in case you don't, ecosystem services are the tangible benefits that nature provides. And these can include a wide range of things that contribute to healthy economies and quality of life in human communities, including water quality and quantity, reduced flood damage, stormwater management, carbon sequestration, fish and wildlife habitat, recreational aesthetic benefits, et cetera, which can be obtained at low cost and in perpetuity. So this is the same bill that was up last session, ran into some problems in Ways and Means, but there are a couple of concerns that came up that I just want to address right off the bat. One of them is that this bill does not impose any new regulations. It doesn't impose any new fees or any new taxes, and that was obviously by design. It is also a concern from the other side, the environmental side. It doesn't relieve anybody of obligations to comply with existing regulations. It just offers a little bit of flexibility in compliance and how people meet the expectations of those regulations. And the bill in its current form has no fiscal impact. It had a fiscal impact in its earlier version because there was a position attached to it for the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. The legislature approved this position in the budget process during the last session, so the position is in place already and there's a person in it, but the bill has yet to direct the position what to do. So it was taken care of in the last session. So what do we expect the outcomes to be? Well, we expect the outcome to be overall improved efficiency and cost effectiveness of conservation programs to make them more sustainable and produce better outcomes. And this can be language concerning this outcome can be found in sections 1, 4, and 5. It also improves the integration across multiple jurisdictions, which often have duplicative responsibilities that can be handled better if the coordination is improved. So it addresses that in Section 2 with the integration of multiple state conservation plans that the state produces. In Section 3, which deals with the Institute for Natural Resources, it simply asks them to continue providing information to support the development of measurements for ecosystem services, which is, if these things are going to be bought and sold, you can't do it without being able to measure them. The measurements out there now are not consistent. This just encourages them to continue providing information to help people do that. In Section 4, it encourages agencies and local governments to use natural infrastructure where appropriate rather than engineering solutions for things like stormwater management. A lot of this is happening already, but it encourages this continuation. Section 4 deals with mitigation. It provides general guidance to try to improve the effectiveness and efficiency of mitigation programs, which sometimes aren't very efficient or effective, haven't been in the past. And the overall approach here is to provide general policy direction to encourage agencies to be innovative and creative in meeting their and developers and others in meeting their regulatory responsibilities to be more cost effective and work better. It also validates Oregon's reputation as a leader in this arena. I believe Oregon was the first to pass a bill, Senate Bill 513, to address these issues in the 2009 session. So at the end of this is a list of the organizations that that supported the bill in the last session, 2011 session, which was House Bill 3109. And most of those I have written statements for if you'd like to see them, but I didn't include them.
All right, thank you.
Thank you.
Yep. Why don't you go ahead and please state your name for the record.
Hey, Chair Dingfelter, rest of the committee, thank you. My name is Bobby Cochran with Willamette Partnership. And Willamette Partnership is a nonprofit coalition of business, agriculture, environment, university, other leaders throughout the Willamette. We work across Oregon, Washington, and Idaho to really expand the pace of conservation, really asking that question. If we look at the hundreds of millions of dollars that we're spending on the environment now, you take a step back and ask Mother Nature or the river or the land how they would spend it, we try and match those up a little bit better. And I think what this bill does is it helps provide some of that flexibility in how we implement our investments now to get that match up a little bit better. And I wanted to give some specific examples of that because Oregon really is looked nationally as one of the leaders in this field. And that recognition has helped leverage a lot of private and federal investment into Oregon just in the last year or so. One of those examples just happened recently. The Department of Environmental Quality issued a wastewater permit for the city of Medford that basically is going to turn $10 million into 30 miles of stream restoration on the Rogue River instead of building an expensive chilling equipment. Now, for a long time, you've heard the story of Clean Water Services in their 2001 permit that saved their ratepayers $100 million by planting 35 miles of stream. Now, with Clean Water Services in Medford, you have two examples where communities are investing in restoration in a way that's keeping utility rates at fairly level. And so that has a real impact on people's pocketbooks. And restoration really does provide jobs. University of Oregon studies finding that for every $1 million that you spend on restoration, you get 16 to 20 jobs. So $10 million translates into jobs. And these approaches are helping attract federal dollars. This summer with Freshwater Trust and Willamette Partnership received about $2 million in grants from U.S. Department of Agriculture to expand these programs throughout the Northwest. And $666,000 of that is going to go directly into conservation in the Willamette and Rogue River basins. So that's significant investment. It's also helping us work with landowners. Willamette Partnership is working with Salmon Safe right now with Willamette Valley Vineyards and other growers so that when a vineyard goes and gets Salmon Safe certified for all the sustainable agriculture that they do, not only do they get that nice little label on their wine bottle that helps them sell their wine, they can also generate ecosystem service credits for water quality or the habitat benefits they provide to generate additional revenue for their operation. We're also working closely with state agencies like the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board and Oregon Department of Forestry to use some of these methodologies and credit calculation terms to articulate the benefits of management. So, for example, Oregon Department of Forestry is quantifying the water quality and salmon benefits of management on some of their Tillamook forest lands. Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, we've been working with in the Klamath Basin to articulate the nutrient benefits of some of their restoration work. And that connects the investments that we're making as a state directly to downstream users in a way that the public can understand. And the final piece is there really is an economic development driver to this, that you've got private investors around the country and federal investors looking at Oregon as a leader. They're looking at statements that the legislature makes, and that's helping attract investment because it's providing certainty to those investors that we're serious about making this work. So that $2 million that came in from the U.S. Department of Agriculture, they look closely at Senate Bill 513, and that statement from the legislature made a difference in attracting those funds. It also makes a difference in terms of the state agencies being able to provide some of that flexibility that allows us to invest in what the land, nature, and our economy really wants. Okay. So I'll stop there.
Thank you. Mr. Chandler.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, and I know when we appeared on this bill last session, it raised a few eyebrows to have a development group backing something with words in it like ecosystems. And we were here out of purely selfish reasons. We didn't go undergo a wholesale conversion. We are a very regulated industry. We're very regulated on environmental issues and are regulated by a variety of different entities from the federal to the state to the local, all of which have, as was mentioned earlier, conflicting and overlapping and sometimes outright contradictory requirements of us. And yet, in order to get our permits pulled, even when we ever start pulling permits again, we have to somehow wade through those thickets of regulations. And in this regulating of the environment, in this bill, one of the things about it, as has already been mentioned, it doesn't affect the underlying regulations. That's a separate conversation on a separate piece of legislation I'd be happy to have. But it assumes that all the laws on the book stay there. What it does, hopefully, is create a different way of implementing those laws to get the benefit, because what I believe happens so often in the regulatory system is the regulations take on a life of their own, and we lose track of what it was the regulation was trying to do in the first place. The purpose behind a wetland mitigation measure, for example, is to preserve the functional quality of wetlands so that we don't diminish the number of those in the ecosystem because of the benefits that wetlands provide. It isn't to create work for people making new wetlands. It isn't to create wetlands that are going to fail or anything else, and yet that's what the regulations tend to force developers into. And what frustrates my folks tremendously is being told if you fill a wetland, if you affect a wetland, if you're near a wetland, for example, then you have to mitigate. Oftentimes the mitigation measure, sometimes the wetland in question isn't all that fancy of a wetland, and yet the law says you got to do something about it. So in order to mitigate, you create another wetland that's probably, and oftentimes is, just as crummy as the first one that you're working on in the first place, and yet that's what the law forces you to do. You create a mitigation that is going to fail because there's nobody there to maintain it. Same thing applies to stormwater management when we do biofiltration systems and swales and such as that. And so the net environmental gain oftentimes doesn't happen. There's a lot of compliance and a lot of cost, but there really isn't necessarily an improvement in the ultimate objective of the regulation. What this bill would do, I hope, and the reason we're supportive of it, is to create a different conversation than the one we've had and move beyond, here's what the rules say, go follow these 17 steps, and if the outcome is silly, there you go, follow the 17 steps, to trying to figure out a different way to approach so that we actually are improving the environment and having development occur at the same time. And one of the best examples was already mentioned. Mr. Cochran referenced the Clean Water Services approach some years back of planting trees to cool a water body that would have otherwise required very fancy cooling equipment. I was told by one of the permit writers that worked on the Clean Water Services permit that probably wasn't legal. And had it been challenged in court, probably would have been thrown out. Now it's in place now, the statute has run, everybody's happy, but it was a very common sense approach and a very, very smart approach that under the law as it existed probably wasn't quite within the 17 steps. So I don't know if this bill will work or not, to be perfectly honest with you, and I would not want to take a quiz on all the provisions of it, and I'm not sure that it's poetry the way it's written. But the intent of it, and I think where it will take us to, is a chance to have different cross-jurisdictional, cross-agency conversations about very important topics that will allow the end result to be better than what our current system gives us, and to do so at less cost to the applicant trying to get a permit through. Commend it to you if and when that time comes. We're glad to take any questions.
Okay. Thank you. We're going to take a few questions. Want to remind folks that this is just an informational hearing, and we will have a full public hearing most likely the first week of February. So with that, questions?
Hot dog.
I'll reserve my questions until it's official. How's that?
Okay. Do you have some burning questions,
Senator? I do have some burning questions.
Okay.
I put a lot of research into this, and one of the comments you made, ma'am, was that there were quite a diverse group of people on the work group, and you're correct, there was. But when I read down through this SB 513 work group, I don't see anything of home builders, developers, public input, Willamette Partnership, EcoTrust, Forest Service. Seems to be all government agencies. Can you explain why there wasn't more on this work group?
Yes, and the list you have there on my paper is not the list of the people participating in the work group. That would be in this publication here. Oh, that one, okay. Yeah, there were actually two work groups. There was a work group that did kind of slog through all the details of the recommendations, and then there was another group called the Ad Hoc Committee. And the Ad Hoc Committee was a committee that provided more general advice about strategy and approach and whatnot. And one of the members of the Ad Hoc Committee was John Miller. John Miller is a developer here in Salem. And, John, weren't you on that Ad Hoc Committee as well?
I probably... And they run together,
right? And there was another person on.
Thank you.
Was it I believe on the Ad Hoc Committee, Earth Advantage?
Yes.
Yes, they were also on the group, and so we did make an effort to include
follow
them
up.
And
to follow up,
seek their views.
In some other documentation that I have on this ecosystem services and markets, and to me, basically, I see this as a cap and trade of rainwater. And it bothers me because when you talk about we have a 2-degree temperature differential and we're able to plant trees upstream, and we talked about this, it doesn't mitigate the 2-degree temperature change. That 2-degree temperature change still goes into the system. We just plant trees someplace else to make that water colder to try to balance it off. One of the things that bothers me about this program is the fact that it's stated in this document, Senate Bill 513, Ecosystem Services and Markets Executive Summary, the incentive to participate in such programs could be streamlined, permitting and reduced administrative costs as compared with traditional compliance mechanisms. However, regulated parties, i.e. developers, could satisfy their obligations under natural resource statutes by investing in the ecosystem service projects or credits that provide measurable ecological outcomes and have the potential to result in multiple benefits to the environment. So basically what you're saying is that, boy, if you go this way, it'll be cheaper and easier for you to do it, and we'll run the process. If you want to go the other way, we're going to go through the old process system. That kind of bothers me. It's almost like you're extorting. You do it this way, or your project doesn't move.
I think maybe John should respond to that.
Senator Olson, Madam Chair. We probably ought to talk offline because I read better than I listen to see what the language you're citing to. But I can think, as you were talking, of several examples where, as long as it's not compulsory, in the land use statutes, for example, there's a provision for you can have a clear and objective path for getting a project approved. You can have a discretionary path for getting a project approved. The clear and objective is less hoops. The discretionary may develop a project that, you know, may be more in line with the developer's objectives. And as long as those options exist and there isn't an explicit or implicit forcing, it allows the private sector to say, yes, I can do this preemptive path, I'm happy with the outcome, or no, I want to buy a more complicated process, we're fine with that. And in other areas. Now, in this one, like I said, I'd want to take another look at what you just referred to make sure the example would hold. But generally speaking, our position has been, if we're not forced, if it's an open decision by the applicant to decide process A or process B, where one is maybe faster but more expensive and the other is less expensive but takes more time, then that's up to the applicant to decide which way they want to go. And as long as, again, if it's not compulsory, we tend to support those.
But the point being, it said it could be streamlined permitting. In other words, they're dangling that carrot. We could streamline your process. We know it's going to take some time. We know time is dollars. So we could streamline this process if you go this way. Or we could not streamline the process. And that's what bothers me. This is kind of cities and counties do this all the time. I've developed. It's always, we will allow this if you give. And that concerns me.
Madam Chair, Senator Olson, it concerns me as well. And I will state that we're prone to looking for the pony sometimes, and the pony is hard to find, as the old joke has it. I think that, and oftentimes, if this is a bait and switch, we will be very unhappy. I think the intention of this is not that. Now, how it will get implemented at the regulatory level is a separate conversation, what the agencies will do, what the local governments will do. But I share that same concern.
I have another question.
Okay.
I took a wonderful tour of clean water yesterday, and I looked at your map and all that, and we talked about this, the size and
and scope of what that system covers. And the question I asked at that point was, there are a finite number of miles of streams, creeks, watersheds, et cetera, et cetera. And if we get into this process, basically what we're creating is a market for streams that are owned by Oregonians, and we rent these streams out for to take care of, we plant trees, et cetera. If we come back to a normal real estate market, a normal economy again, and we get a burst of building and development, what happens when we run out of this finite number of streams? And in your case, you have all the way to Henry Hague Lake, and you've got a monstrous area. But like Canby has a smaller area with watershed, smaller watershed responsibility. What happens if development in my town of Canby is so enormous that we run out of these areas? Which is a question I asked when we were in discussion at, in my office, that do we now pay mitigation fees to Eastern Oregon to mitigate a problem that's created in Canby? The problem isn't solved. We still have the water problem, but we've just paid somebody else to take care of part of it. That's why I come up with the cap and trade of ecosystems.
So since we had a chance to look at some of the projects, you know, the other day, we've gone back and looked at some of these questions of, you know, if we were wildly successful and everyone wanted to go and do restoration on Oregon streams, first, we think that'd be pretty good. And the second piece is in the Willamette Basin alone, if every single industrial municipal wastewater facility were to plant trees to offset their thermal load, so basically we all take hot showers. We're not going to stop taking hot showers anytime soon. Rather than building a bunch of mechanical chillers, everybody in the Willamette Basin went and planted trees. We need about 600 miles of stream restored. Right now, we probably get about 100 miles done a year statewide. That'd be a big jump. There's 16,000 miles to restore in the Willamette. So 600 into 16,000, we think there's some room there. The other piece, if you look at the Rogue River Basin, that you have the cities investing in 30 miles of stream. Analysis is looking at saying there's 890 miles that need restoration in the upper Rogue Basin. So in terms of having multiple competition for riparian areas for restoration, we don't see that happening in, you know, the next 50 years or so.
Just to follow up, I think what Senator Olson is raised a concern about is the scale. What I was hearing is concern about limiting it to, for instance, just a Tualatin Basin or a portion of, I'm trying to think, what's the creek in, or it's is it Malala or?
Pudding?
Pudding River. Mm-hmm. What I'm hearing is you're looking at a large-scale hydrologic unit such as the Willamette or Rogue, quite a big basin where you would be doing trading in between at a much larger scale. That's why I think I'm here. I mean, I've heard you talk about the Willamette, not just within the Tualatin. So is that, am I correct in characterizing that?
Well, I think just to separate kind of how this stuff works in practice versus what the bill doesn't specify any of that.
Yeah.
And then how it works in practice depends on which type of natural resource you're talking about. If you're talking about wetlands and you have an impact in Canby, you're going to need to focus on the Malala Pudding area. And even, I would say, within Malala Pudding, you have enough land to be able to go and do that work. We're not going to run into a situation where you have an impact on the west side of Oregon and you're doing the restoration on the east side to make up for it. You're going to try and keep that mitigation as close to where the impact is as possible.
Did you want to jump in? On the Willamette partnership, you're looking throughout the Willamette, is my understanding, not just...
Yeah, we have our roots in the Willamette, but we work across the Northwest now.
I just wanted if Senator Olson could say that thing about a burst of building and development again.
That's it's music to your ears, right?
That's a long time.
Yeah.
Okay, it sounds like there may be some follow-up to make sure that all the concerns that were raised here are addressed, and possibly with Senator Przanski, who seems to have a question
up on
as well.
Us.
I might want to check in with him before February. So with that, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Don't rush to my office, please.
We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Jeez.
And I'm going to call up the next panel, our last committee bill, which I just lost my agenda. So LC 293, which is relating to water right leases. And we have Katie Fast, David Pills, and Brenda Bateman. You guys can all come up together. That'd be great. Okay, who wants to go first? Actually, David, want to go ahead?
Absolutely. Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Olson, members of the committee. My name is David Pills. I'm from the Freshwater Trust. I'm the Flow Restoration Director with Freshwater Trust. First, I want to thank you for considering this legislative concept today. And then, if possible, I'd like to reserve a couple minutes for Tony Malmberg to come up and talk as well. Tony came over from Union, Oregon, and he works with us doing flow restoration work, and he has some good things to say about this as well. So I'll be fast. In 2012, Oregon will adopt its first long-term integrated water resource strategy. The express purpose of the integrated water resource strategy is to balance in-stream and out-of-stream needs, both now and in a future where climate change and population growth have increased competition over scarce water resources. Split-season in-stream leasing is an elegant and powerful tool to balance the needs of freshwater ecosystems with the needs of water users, especially farmers and ranchers that grow hay and alfalfa. In a nutshell, legislative concept 293 is a simple one. All it does is remove the current sunset of split-season in-stream leasing, which exists in the law. The split-season in-stream leasing law is set to sunset in 2014. Split-season in-stream leasing is a special brand of temporary water use authorization that allows the split use of a water right, part in-stream and part out-of-stream. It does not allow injury, does not allow enlargement of a water right. These leases are approved by the Oregon Water Resource Department in a way such that they have no negative or literally no impact on neighboring water rights. Split-season leasing is also a fee-based program, so it will not have any budgetary implications. But I believe the most persuasive reason to keep split-season leasing on the books is that it's the most flexible tool Oregon has to balance in-stream and out-of-stream needs. I'm going to let Tony, as I said, talk a little bit about this in more detail, but I wanted to point you towards the figures on the handout that you just got. These data come from some work that Tony's done out in the La Grande Valley and also conversations he's had with farmers and ranchers and extension agents in John Day and Grant County area. But on the front page, you see this plot of plant growth versus stream flows. A lot of hay and alfalfa plants are what we call cool season plants. Their growth plateaus late in the summer when the days get hot and long. This also corresponds to the time period when stream flows are lowest. The result, and if you look at the backside, is that the production from an acre foot of water in the late summer is just a fraction of what it is early in the year in terms of hay or alfalfa or other cool season crops. At the same time, during this time of year, streams are low and fish and ecosystems need water the most. Groups like the Freshwater Trust and the Deschutes River Conservancy are willing to compensate landowners for doing split season in-stream leases. And our levels of compensation can far exceed the observed value of water for late summer hay production. You can see on there the minimum that we pay, you know, what we pay for an acre foot of water ranges from $35 up to $150 for an acre foot of water leased in stream, whereas, you know, some observed values of late season hay are only about $10 per acre foot. So we can offer considerable benefit to the landowner for just that late season portion of water while they can maintain that higher crop value earlier in the season. Before I end, just very briefly, I'll summarize. Thank you very much for considering this concept. Split-season leasing is a flexible, water user-friendly, and fish-friendly tool that deserves to become a permanent feature of Oregon law. Finally, if Oregon is serious about balancing in-stream and out-of-stream needs, as we have indicated in our soon-to-be-adopted integrated water resource strategy, split-season leasing is absolutely one of the best mechanisms for doing so. Thank you again for your time, and I'll be happy to answer questions.
Since we're running short on time, I'm going to ask you ladies if you could be really brief, because you'll be coming back. And then since we have somebody that came over from Eastern Oregon, I want to make sure we have time and before we move on to our last bill. So thank you, Katie.
Chair Dingfelder, members of the committee, for the record, Katie Fass with the Oregon Farm Bureau. We were supportive of the legislation when it was originally introduced with the sunset. Our feeling was the sunset gave the ability of review. I have not received any negative comments about how the program's being implemented. We're supportive of the introduction. I will let you know my water committee is meeting next week, and we're going to review this legislation and get input from folks. So there's more to come in February.
Okay. Thank you. Brenda?
Madam Chair, thank you, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Brenda Bateman with the Oregon Water Resources Department. Just here to provide a little bit of background today and take any questions you may have about the technical aspects of the program. David covered the mechanics very well. Just wanted to reiterate for you that this is a program that's been in place for the past decade and has worked well for the department, its customers, and the environment. I'll skip over most of my description of the program, but I did want to emphasize two pieces, and that is eligibility, that the controls that are on this program and how folks are eligible to participate. So very first of all, water right holders need to meet some basic eligibility requirements. That's something that we look at. And fundamentally, they must hold a water right that is called subject to transfer. Usually that means they have a certificated right in hand and can move water around. And the second piece is that participants in this program are required to measure and report their water use to our water master to ensure that there is no enlargement of the right and no injury to other water right holders. The water master uses this information actively in the field to manage the water resource. So that's an important piece that's on there that we wanted you to know about. Those are the program basics, and we're happy to take any questions you have.
Okay. Thank you, Brenda. Sorry.
No.
So why don't we have... Actually, let's see if there's any questions first, and then we'll have yes from Eastern Oregon. Any questions before we ask last
no.
person? Okay. So, David, do you want to introduce
yourself?
Yeah.
Tony Malmberg is a colleague of mine. He's the Freshwater Trust John Day Basin Project Manager. Tony comes from Union, Oregon, so he commutes up and over the beautiful Elk Mountains to John Day a lot, but he also has a lot of background as a rancher in Wyoming for 30 years and now in Oregon, and he's really helped us develop a lot of this information that we have on the benefits of split season leasing, and he's doing an incredible job of spreading the gospel out in Grant County and elsewhere. So I wanted him to talk a little bit more about his operation over in Union County.
Thank you. Thanks for making the trip out here today. Are you getting much snow over there on the east side?
Chair Dingfelder, thanks, from the committee. I talked to my wife this morning. They had 6 inches last night.
Excellent. Yeah. And can you just state your name for the record also, please?
Tony Malmberg.
Thank you.
I'm from Union, Oregon, and the handout I gave you, you can call a case study. These are actual numbers from our alfalfa production on a 20-acre field. And it's based on the actual records. And as you can see, very quickly, the value of the water for the third cutting is worth a lot more than the hay that you can produce in the third cutting. And the John Day, the first handout that David handed out to you, most of that was based on native high country, native meadows, native hay. And it would have been foregoing the aftergrowth on the hay, and usually in grazing, but they value it in hay. It's pretty obvious that this can be a really good tool for ranchers to use in different situations.
Okay. So just a quick question. So are you, I'm trying to figure out what the net would be for you after, with your deferred costs and then the additional costs that you're getting for the split season leasing. I didn't see that on your sheet.
Okay, you can see on the top there that the value of the hay and the third cutting would be $37.50. Would be the net value of the hay.
Okay.
The water that it takes to grow that hay is worth $95 in the column underneath third cutting, water value. You see that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And this is based on the net irrigation requirements, a publication by OWRD and a bunch of other folks. And as you read there, it says there takes 13.44 inches of irrigation. Now, that is for 9 out of 10 years to do that. Now, last year, we actually only, you know, it was a wet season, we actually only used 9 inches of irrigation last year.
Okay.
And as David said, we would, if this split season lease is approved, we would have measuring device measure the actual water that we do use and have a quantification of how much is returned in stream, and we'd be paid accordingly.
Okay. Any questions?
I do have one.
Mm-hmm.
Sir, you said that salmon benefit from more hot season flow. What do you mean by hot season flow?
In July, during the hot season,
cool
season plants stop growing at about when the temperature reaches 70 degrees ambient temperature, cool season plants shut down.
Okay.
And during that season, the salmon would benefit from having cooler water and flow in stream. I think it's interesting. Water was always kind of free in our culture, but if we look at it like it has a value, view it like an input, like fertilizer, like something that costs money that you apply to get added value to that for that product. And if we view it like that, it's a little different picture.
You change the equation a little bit.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for providing a real-life example. I think it's really helpful, always, for the committee to hear that. And certainly, we'll make sure, and I don't know if you'll be able to come back in February. If not, maybe David can make sure and introduce this information into the record. And certainly, if you wanted to submit written testimony or call in, we'd be happy to accommodate that so you don't have to make the trip over here again.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for coming here today. And with that, we'll hear our last informational hearing. Or should we do the introduction now?
You can do the introduction.
Yeah, I think what we'll do is I think I'm going to do the work session now. Colleagues, we have one more legislative concept, but as I mentioned, it's not a committee bill, but it was a request to see if we can just do an informational hearing on it. So we're going to now take a break from the informational hearings and do the work session, and then we'll close with that informational hearing on LC26. We're going to hold over the informational meeting on the 10-year energy action plan. Michael Young could not be here today due to the weather. So since there's nothing time sensitive, we've decided we're going to hold that over until February.
We get 10 years.
not quite on that. So what we'll do is we're going to go ahead and open up a work session. Just a reminder, do you want to do the introductions on that?
Sure.
Do you have a script for me? Just a reminder for committee members that this is motions are to be made for introduction purposes only, and that does not reflect your opinions or your positions on the bills. So with that, I will take a motion. We are in a work session.
Chair Dingfelder, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 157, dated December 14th, 2011. LC 236, dated January 3rd, 2012. And LC 293, dated December 19th, 2011.
Okay, Center also moves the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 157, dated December 14th, 2011. LC 236, dated January 3rd, 2012, and LC 293, dated December 19th, 2011. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Okay, seeing none, the motion passes and the committee bills are introduced. With that, I will close the work session on the committee bill introductions. I will reopen an informational meeting on the LC26 relating to beverage containers. We have Joe Gilliam and Palmer Mason.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
and John Anderson, why don't you come up as well? We'll do it all together, okay?
And Sean is here for Joe.
Okay. Oh, that's right. We get the other Gilliam. Okay. Sean is here in place of Joe Gilliam. Yeah. John Anderson is also going to provide us an update on House Bill 3145, the implementation of that bill. So, Palmer, why don't you go ahead first, and then we can just sort of do this all together since it's not officially a bill introduction.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Palmer Mason with the Department of Environmental Quality. Want to talk about this LC 26. This is a bill that was really a carryover from last session. The legislature passed changes to the bottle bill, adding additional containers, providing a trigger for a potential increase in the refund value of containers. And then John's going to talk a little bit about the pilot project language that was in the bill and the implementation that the Oregon Beverage Co-op is undertaking. But one piece of the work on the bottle bill last year that didn't happen was the essence of this legislative concept 26, and that was language that the distributors and the beverage co-op wanted to move in set up their co-op, and also to deal with reporting of information to the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The department didn't really have any position on that legislation, and we really don't have any position on most of the underlying legislative concept except for one issue. I misspoke, two issues. One is very technical. The larger issue is the legislative concept has a provision in it that provides confidentiality for distributors both within the co-op and those who are out of the co-op to provide information to the Oregon Liquor and Control Commission. And actually, the language in the legislative concept is mostly about, as it's currently drafted, about providing confidentiality protection, to the distributors who are in the co-op. The information they're reporting is the number of containers that are returned in a calendar year and the number of containers that are sold in a calendar year. And as you can appreciate, that information, particularly the latter information, the number of containers sold, would be something that the distributors would want to keep confidential, not wanting to have one beverage company know the sales of another beverage company. That's very proprietary information, and we certainly understand that. The real issue, though, is the way that language is written. It is so broad that the legislature, the public, no one would really know how well the bottle bill is working or not working. And we couldn't really have the information to evaluate whether the law is working as intended. Because, again, it protects from disclosure all the information that is sent to the commission. Both those two numbers that I talked about, the number of containers sold and the number of containers returned, and the commission wouldn't be able to then reveal to the legislature or the public what the actual return rate was for the containers. And I think most of us would acknowledge that's an important number to have, to know what our return rate is under the bottle bill, to again evaluate whether the bottle bill is working and to ensure accountability. So there's been discussions about some amendments to rework that particular provision in the legislative concept so that the Liquor Commission could provide the percentage number. This is the percentage return, both as a statewide for all the container types, and when I say container types, the material types, I'm talking plastic, glass, and metal, as well as individually for each of those material types. And that way, again, the public, the legislature, all of us would know how well the bottle bill is working, and we'd have a way of tracking its success and ensuring accountability. And my understanding is that the industry is supportive of making those changes. So that's been the department's primary interest in this particular bill, is just ensuring that the information was available to the policymakers and to the public on measuring the success of the bottle bill. The other small technical change that we were interested in is this legislative concept is drafted so that the reporting on some of the containers is on aluminum containers as opposed to metal. And we suggested that the language be changed from aluminum to metal so that the reporting is, again, on metal containers as opposed to just aluminum. There are some imported beers and other things that are actually sold in steel containers, and since they're covered under the bottle bill. We also ought to get the reporting on those particular containers. And so I think there, again, it's another amendment where I believe the industry is supportive of that change. So that's been the department's interest in this legislation. And I can take any questions. Or
I'm going to have Sean just do a quick update, and then because we have 5 minutes for both of you, and then we'll take questions. And then, John, if you can close with an update, that'd be great.
Great. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Sean Miller. I'm here today on behalf of the Northwest Grocery Association in support of LC 26. And, you know, as Palmer indicated, there is an amendment to the extra draft that you have dealing with changing aluminum to metal, which we are fine with, as well as clarifying the reporting mechanism, again, which we are okay with. And that is in legislative council, and we are scheduled to meet with them this afternoon, so we hope to have that revised in a revised version before February. You know, as for the LC 26, last session with the passage of House Bill 3145, and then in 2007, when the last rewrite of the bottle bill occurred, there is, again, we view two implementation issues left to clear up. Again, one going back to 2007. And how the industry had to evolve and change because of that expansion of the bottle bill. And then again, the reporting mechanism, which was as a result of 3145 from last session, that we built in triggers in the expansion and the into the bill. And it's important to know what those redemption rates are. And so, you know, having the cooperative, John's group, report the aggregate, and then having OLCC publish that particular data is important to actually implementing, as Palmer indicated, 3145 from last session. One other issue, again, in the bill, it goes back to when 2007, the last, before 3145 passed, and when the industry had to change because they were then required to take back all containers, whether they sold that product or not, which was a major change in the industry. And because of that, the entire industry had to change. And one of the reasons why John is here today with the statewide cooperative, it was really the only way to track the nickel. And again, when you track the nickel from consumer, distributor to grocer, consumer, back to the grocer, to get that back and made everybody whole, it requires a nickel depository. That's essentially what John is, other than the, you know, actually making the bottle bill work and collecting all those containers statewide. However, there's still, you know, a very small minority of folks who don't want to participate in the system. And if you do not participate in the cooperative, the problem is at the grocery level, you have to, you essentially have to do a completely different sort for that distributor who does not participate in the cooperative. Right now, John comes to a store, picks everything up. If you don't participate in the cooperative, we have to essentially do a special sort for them. All this does is correct. Again, it doesn't make them at all join the cooperative. It just makes them to get the grocer whole on the nickel because of all that work that we have to do in the back room. We give them the accounting. They give us the nickel, so everybody's made whole in that process, and we don't have to do that separate sort. And so that's essentially, the two issues, dealing with that issue on the cooperative language, setting that up and how that's going to function, as well as the reporting mechanism. And with that, Madam Chair, I'll conclude my testimony. Okay.
John, why don't you go ahead? We're pretty much out of time. If you can give us the one-minute summary, and then if you want to come back in February, you're welcome to.
Sure. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is John Anderson. I'm president of Oregon Beverage Recycling Co-op. And the one-minute version of where we're at with redemption centers is we did seek and get approval from the OLCC for our test site that was allowed under House Bill 3145. It's in South Salem on Commercial Street. We've signed a lease and have begun the remodel efforts at that space, and we hope to be open sometime around the second week in March. We have seven retailers that are participating in the redemption center. In two different convenience zones, one that is made up of a mile and a half radius and another that's made up of a 3 mile radius. The retailers that are inside the 1.5 mile radius are not required to take containers back. those that are outside or in the 3 mile radius are required to take back up to 24 containers a day from any customer that comes in. And so our test really is to see whether the expanded convenience zone that 3145 provided us works. We have seen great success with our two that we have open in Village and Oregon City. And so we'll see where we're at in Salem in a year or so.
Great, thank you. Questions?
I have one question for Palmer. On the confidentiality agreement, does OLCC have audit authority to make sure that the numbers they're given are accurate?
Senator Olson, that's a great question. I know that was debated some during the 2011 session, and you know, I'll be honest, I'm not sure I know or recall what the answer was on that.
We have an OLCC person here, and he's throwing up his hands. Just for folks on who are watching, he's throwing up his hands with a question. So I'm hopeful that by February we can get the answer to that question. And I'm also looking at OLCC to make sure that they ask their counsel to clarify that, because I think that's a very important question that needs to be answered. So with that, are there any other announcements? We'll see you all back here in a few weeks. And with that, we will close the informational hearing and close the Senate Interim Committee on Environment and Natural Resources.
On time and under budget.